creative zoning with some very bright people like Jeffrey Farrell. But it's very important for me to point out, falling off the bottom of the slide there, I'm not an attorney. So all the attorneys in the room can calm down. I'm going to talk about these implementation issues from the planning perspective and not from the attorney's perspective. I'm going to show you a little bit about why you might want to do a form-based code, talk about some barriers, talk a bit about plan implementation and how we think form-based code fits into plan implementation, slam customized zoning for a little bit, and then talk a little bit about theory versus reality. So, my personal opinion, never having stepped foot much in Montgomery County until now, you don't need a full-blown form-based code for the entire county, okay? So I think that's one of the things you need to focus on, is that the form-based code is for portions of the community, and you need to be thinking about which portions are the most appropriate first. The fact of the matter, though, is that you might eventually want to improve what I call the form standards that are in your code for the entire county, even the residential districts. And a great example of this are mansionization issues, which we have all around the country, are a problem as exactly like the one described by Jeffrey earlier, where nobody would ever build a house as big as the zoning ordinance would actually let them build, right? And then all of a sudden, we've discovered that if you have enough land, you can have a 6,000, an 8,000, a 10,000 square foot house. So we've got a whole lot of issues that can be dealt with by better form standards. How do we do plan implementation today? This is my personal brief description of how you do it here in Montgomery County, so I apologize if I get it slightly wrong, but we do sector planning, at least especially in Prince George's County, they spend their time calling them that, which defines an official vision for a specific area. We then take our toolkit and we implement the vision. Here you have a little bit of flexibility in the toolkit given the optional method, which probably has some issues if you think about Jeffrey's presentation especially. And then you have the site plan process in which you have the building community coming forward and actually implementing the vision. And right now, in this county, that is a heavily negotiated process. And so you need to stop and think about the steps at which you are trying to achieve good development. And the most important step, I think most, especially citizens, would say in this process is that final one, when in fact the most important step perhaps ought to have been the first one, the planning process. Transparency and certainty. These are the two things that we look for in, I think, in every process of government. We are looking for transparency, meaning we understand as citizens or anyone else what the rules are, what's going on, what are the steps, and some certainty, meaning we know that after step A, there'll be step B, there'll be step C and D. Well, the fact of the matter is transparency and certainty doesn't often exist. As the attorneys in the room will tell you, that they work in this process only because it needs advocates, and it needs advocates only because it's currently not certain. We have a really, really, really hard time just saying no. We'll hear about the market on the one hand and the community's interest on the other hand as though those were in absolute opposition, and sometimes we've just got to work with those ideas and get them together a little bit. One of the things that we do very, very badly is we don't explain to people why we want to do zoning. Why are we doing this? Why do you have to regulate this specific thing? Well, I think it all goes back to why we started zoning, and Jeffrey gave you some pictures versions of this, but the fact of the matter is we have three reasons why we zone. We have market failures. We don't protect the common interest. We, in fact, allow individual interest to exceed our common interest in a common shared vision. We have separation of uses. It used to be the tannery. Today, it would be something else, probably the sexually oriented business. We have light and air, the bulk standards, originally focused on making tenement houses healthier places to live. But if you look at the recent activity on suburban subdivision and health, you'll find that we are continued to be interested in regulating for the public health And I fundamentally, this is why we would regulate. Okay, we want to fix one of these things. That's why we would have any tools at all. So why would we use a form-based code? Well, I think there are two places, two instances in which we want form-based codes, where we're creating a new place by densifying or intensifying a current place, for example, or where we're trying to protect the character of an existing place, where we're undoing suburbanization that's happened, for example, or where we're trying to protect the character of a place that we're trying to grow up into being a real place. What happens when we try to do placemaking? Well, we find that the original toolkit we were given, zoning and subdivision, those two often separate tools, mean that we have a hard time building a good so-called public realm, meaning the space between the face of one building and the face of another building. If we step right outside this building, we can stand on the right-of-way line, and that's the line between zoning and subdivision. Subdivision builds streets. That's where our roads are. That's where we exact all the kinds of things that make sure that we can connect the pipes and connect the roads, etc. To build that whole atmosphere in one consistent scheme requires zoning and subdivision to be working in concert, and that's rarely true. One of the other problems is planning and public works. Again, we have something that is often described as a silo effect. I understand that Peter Park was here, and our work in Denver has really highlighted how problematic the silo effect is in Denver, where the public works director and the parks director, if it's a street with a tree-lined median, the parks director is in control of it, and the public works director, who's in control of maintaining the streets and handling parking, etc., all have to agree on what a good street is. Okay, so sometimes there are conflicts or barriers associated simply with the silos that we build based on the way that we set up our departments. There are also conflicts and barriers between short-term and long-term interests. And again, this goes back to the notion of the market failure. I believe that communities ought to be more interested in long-term interests. That's what planning is supposed to be about. We need to understand current market interest because we aren't going to get anything built in that beautiful empty box Jeffrey showed us unless we are sensitive to what the current market is. But we can literally manipulate the market through regulation if it's in the public interest to do so. We need to understand what the impact of that is, and we need to understand what we're doing, but short-term and long-term goals need to be reconciled. This happens especially with the intensification of existing development, which is what we start talking about when we're talking about infill and redevelopment. So so that Jeff wouldn't have all the cool pictures, I brought some of our cool pictures along, mostly because I was in them. The fact of the matter is, zoning is to the left of me, and subdivision and really public improvements are to the right of me. And so when we take this incipient great place in Peoria, Illinois, the first thing we did was take out the utilities, we widened the sidewalk, added in the lighting, added in the trees, and added the awning on and a little infill development. The fact of the matter is we made a much better place and we didn't change anything about the zoning. Okay? So form-based code is about a little more than just what zoning does. Okay? So that's an important element to remember. Conventional code. What do you do to regulate? Well, you got your zoning ordinance, you got the zoning map, you got your subdivision ordinance, you got the thoroughfare plan, you got all the technical manuals, all of that together. The comparison is, in a form-based code, for the most part, the regulatory elements are in a single document: the form standards, urban space, streets, regulating plan, architectural standards, if they're provided, and the review procedures. There still are the technical manuals that stand outside that need to be reconciled with the vision of the form-based code, but it's like the notion of a unified development code. Here's my personal idealized vision of plan implementation. You have citywide, or in this instance, countywide, comprehensive or functional plans that deal with a framework for thinking about those issues in. They are filled in or provided with greater detail, fleshed out by sector, neighborhood, or area plans. And that planning has to happen in concert. Those two have to be consistent. Montgomery County has a great history of doing a great job on this step. The next step is you've got to get a code, a toolkit that has the ability to implement those plans. As the chair described earlier, you've got a couple plans with no toolkit in place right now. Okay, so there are planning concepts that are happening in which the implementing tools are not quite available yet. So in that instance, you've got to develop some new tools. Finally, you've got a permitting process. And to me, in the idealized world that I'm talking about here, the decisions have been made in the planning process. They have been coded in the preparation of the regulatory tools. And that means the permitting process is purely a technical process which does not need either public involvement or council approval, except when you are amending or replacing one of the other pieces, the plan or the code. Okay? So we're talking about, in most form-based codes, you get the plan in place, illustrative master plan, a code to implement that master plan, and all of the approvals after that, to the extent possible, are done at the lowest technical level possible. So, this is Forward Dallas, a plan by Frigginessy. It exists at 30,000 feet. In fact, the staff describes this as an impressionist painting of the city of Dallas. It's better than Austin, which hasn't redone their plan in almost 30 years now. But it's very soft-edged. Planning at 20,000 feet, again a Frigginessy plan, Blueprint Denver. In this instance, you can see it's based on the lot and block pattern. It actually conforms to reality. It's not an impressionist painting. And then there's planning at 10,000 feet. Call this your sector plan or whatever else, where you're actually designing how spaces relate, how streets relate, how those things all play out on the ground. The code is then an implementation of this lowest level of planning. Okay? So again, why are we regulating? Well, we want to harness those market forces that exist, the desire to be in urban places, to our shared vision of what that urban place can be. And that shared vision has to include the developer's concept of what's happening, the demographer's understanding of what's happening, the fiscal understanding of what's possible. All of those things have to be included in that shared vision. We are also regulating to protect public interests, the public good of a place, and private property owners, one from each other. How much regulation do we need? The answer is just enough. And when Royce described your current zoning ordinance, it seems to me his description, at least, was too much. Maybe we're regulating too much, and maybe we're not regulating the right things. So what's one of the most common problems we encounter when we look at zoning around the country? Reliance on one-time, negotiated, place-by-place solutions. Okay? Whether you call them planned unit development, whatever you call them. Waivers and conditions is Denver's favorite term. Variances, we do that a whole lot. If we were to look at the history of the variances issued by this county, we would find a pattern there that probably means we ought to just code those things and not have variances for them. The simple answer is, if you're not happy with the results of your code, change your code. Okay, this picture here is a delightful story in which brand new commercial mixed-use CMU districts and residential mixed-use RMU districts were prepared and applied in the Gateway area, which is the area between the Denver Airport and the city, as you go through the sort of developing area on the edge of the city. Well, when they applied those districts, as you can see, every single time they applied them with waivers. And it seems to me, if you wrote a new district and went to implement it, and then you had to apply it with waivers every time, you got something wrong. Plan development is supposed to be higher quality, innovative projects that don't fit into our existing districts. It is not intended for circumventing requirements or reducing the quality of development. And yet, in lots of our client communities, that is what we see. Now, how can this be bad? The developer is getting what they need, a development, presumably. the neighborhood and the county have a hand in crafting the answer for this specific development? How could that possibly be a bad thing? Well, to me, looking in from the outside, there are a lot of fairness and equity questions. Okay, if you're Joe Blow, you get treated one way. If you're John Doe from outside the county, you get treated a different way. There is a horrible problem in tracking and enforcing these because we don't know what the rules are, because the rules here are a little bit different from the rules here and a little bit different from the rules here and a little bit different from the rules over there. And worst yet, all these hard-won battles, whether about street cross sections, parking reduction, urban design, any of the kinds of things that we battle out on behalf of a specific project, are not available for all projects in the county after that. Okay, we didn't fix all the street cross sections just because we adopted one good one in a plan development. What we're really doing here is balancing neighborhood interests, in most instances, with a protection of what I call perceived character, because, of course, it's hard to describe what the real underlying character is, but there's a perceived character of a place. We're trying to balance that need with reinvestment and intensification in most instances when we're talking about infill development. Because, as those of you who might be in the building community know, if I buy something and I want to tear down what's there and build something new, the increment of change in the value of that project needs to be 4 or 5x. So if I buy your house and I want to tear it down and replace it, the end result needs to be worth 4 or 5 times what I bought it for. Okay? Those are just some kind of rules of thumb of the marketplace that are important to understand why people ask for so much stuff when they do infill and redevelopment, because the marketplace is demanding that of them. Now, it requires planning and public involvement to get to the kinds of solutions that deal with this problem. There are a whole series of possible code approaches out there, and form-based code happens to be one of them. If you want to regulate use, you look to all of our Euclidean codes. We've got every possible way you can regulate use. Distance separation, all kinds of great ideas for how to regulate uses in Euclidean codes. If you want to deal with impact mitigation, look at some of the performance code work that's been done. If you're just worried about things like glare, noise, et cetera, use performance measures. Also very effective at preservation of the natural environment. Form-based code is really, to me, about mixing of uses because it effectively deals with what I call vertical zoning, different zoning by floor, different uses by floor. It really deals with placemaking and especially deals with that question I mentioned earlier about the public realm. If you're really trying to deal with architecture, which I would argue, and I think Jeffrey would agree, that in most cases you're not trying to deal with a specific architecture, but where you are, design guidelines and pattern books and other mechanisms are available for dealing with architecture specifically. So there's a wide variety of approaches that you should be considering, and form-based is one in the package. The idea of a good, sound planning process leading to a coded outcome is, I believe, the most useful tool that we can put in place. And that means that you've got to show people what you want to generate, and once you've shown them that, then you can code that thing, and they will adopt and understand and appreciate your new code. Form standards are one of the ways that we can code for that thing. Okay. Whether the system happens to be street-based, as this one is, with an equivalent of one zoning district being this purple and another zoning district being this tan color and yet another district being this orange color, those are a street-based set of zoning districts, in essence, and they have standards associated with them that will generate the correct forms along those streets. It really isn't fundamentally a whole lot different from what we've been doing in zoning forever, except that we are coding some different kinds of things. Our building envelope is more sophisticated. It's not just a pat of butter anymore. And in a form-based code, we've got the element of the public realm. The same set of streets, but now we're actually talking about the public portion, what happens between the face of the buildings, which is very, very important to us and we have not paid much attention to in recent years. Now, a lot of people say, well, you know, how do you fit green building, whether into zoning or form-based codes? Well, the fact of the matter is mostly green building ideas are regulated separately. If you look at places like Austin, where I'm from, what they really regulate in their green building requirements are things more related to the building code. That's way down in the level of implementation. Now, some places like City of Chicago have adopted an obligation for green roofs and other measures like that. And you can do that. There's nothing wrong with embedding public policy like that into your regulatory scheme. I would simply provide one caution, and that is when we talk about form-based code, we are not normally talking about a system that can tolerate an incentive-driven option. And the reason I say that is shown in this lovely slide from a brand new code that's being developed in Evanston for downtown Evanston. Maximum public benefit height as opposed to maximum base height. You give me enough stuff, I'll give you some more stuff. That's the deal here. And in Chicago, that deal works well for them. And apparently, they're quite comfortable with going from 25 stories to 42 stories with bonuses. But the fact of the matter is, if you've really coded the form, I would not be comfortable standing up and telling a neighborhood, well, it could be 25 or it could be 42, we're not quite certain. But if it's 42, you're going to get a lot of stuff, and you're really going to like it because it's public benefit stuff. In this case, some of the public benefits were things like widened sidewalks, green roofs, etc. Well, if you want that stuff, code for it and ask for it from everybody. Okay? The incentive-driven system is a farce. What's going to be built on this site is 42 stories tall. The guy's going to provide every incentive he can, and he's going to build the 42-story version. So what do we want in the 42-story version of that building? If we wanted to have a green roof, ask for a damn green roof. Theory versus reality. Plans often cover too large an area. Okay? You can't do urban design level planning countywide in one fell swoop. Okay? It is place specific. Plans and codes often don't have adequate public involvement. That doesn't mean they don't have enough meetings, because they may well have plenty of meetings. But meetings and public involvement may be two different kinds of things. And as you hear from the examples that we talk about this afternoon, we're talking really about a much more hands-on working with the public process. You've heard the word charrette. I'm sure you've probably even had some held here. But the idea of truly getting the public to express what their fundamental interests are in the process of planning for a place. One of the other biggest things, and I learned this from Jeffrey, so I'm not going to take credit for it, the professionals are often given the wrong problem to solve. Okay? Ask an engineer to build a road that will move cars from one place to another place, and he can do it. He can build you a great pipe to move cars with. If that's what you asked him to do, the road looks like what's right outside here. Okay? If what you asked him to do instead was balance modes, pedestrians, cars, bicycles, sensitivity to the retail environment, etc., if you asked him to do that, he'd build you a different street. It's not that engineers are stupid, okay? It's that we've given them the wrong problem to solve. So this whole question about the street and it's the public realm and the correct answers in those places is not about saying, you know, that engineers and public works people are stupid. It's about we've given them the wrong problem to solve. We need to give them a much better problem to resolve. One of the other biggest problems in theory versus reality is that simple planning concepts often get complex when they have to deal with other regulatory frameworks, state and federal legislation, for example, and especially my favorite, property rights. This is Andras Dwani's Transect. Some of you may have seen it before. A beautiful, idyllic model of splitting the city and the countryside into T-zones, running from Mother Nature on the left to the urban core on the right. And the fact of the matter is, when Andras took this system to Miami, and you can all look at the example of the Miami 21 code that they're working on right now, we ended up with a system that has T3, T4, T5, T68, T612, T624, T636A, T636B, T648. The reality is that we're talking about complex issues here, and the simple models don't stay so simple when you apply them on the ground. I think we all understand that, but it's important for us to simply be reminded of that every once in a while. Okay, when you prepare new regulations, I believe personally you need to model the outcomes. And one of the cool things now is for free we can all play around with Google SketchUp. So there is absolutely no reason we shouldn't have a 3D model of everything we're talking about so that we can understand what this stuff looks like. I can tell you that my greatest planning skills came from being able to translate between my dad, trained as an architectural engineer, and my mom, who went through school and got an English degree. Okay? She couldn't work the can opener without help, and the ability to explain to people what things look like in 3D, to walk them through, etc., is critically important. But in addition, modeling outcomes also has to do with some of that numeric stuff that we were talking about before. Financial performance, understanding where people are going to park. All of those things are critically important, but they are not the number one thing that we are looking for. Those fall out of the model. They need to be dealt with. Let's let the technicians figure out how to park something. Let's let the technicians figure out how to get the financing done. There is probably a way, if we have a shared vision, to do something. One reason that people like form-based codes is they have detailed planning, and the planning ends up with a detailed code that implements that plan. They are place specific, and they are a matching implementing system. And we have for many, many, many years relied on zoning, which was so framework that what we got back was a result that did not match our planning. It's like, oops, I guess we didn't think that was going to get built. So in an ideal system, again, my personal opinion, how do we get people involved, and at what levels should they be involved? Well, neighbors. How many neighborhood interests do we have here today? Who considers themselves sort of a neighborhood interest? Good. A nice group. Up front in the planning process, that's your biggest job. Get the planning done right. Okay? To me, you need to be standing there at the code and plan adoption saying, this is a great plan. This is a great code. That's where we ought to be by the time the adoption ought to be happening. We should not be having bloodshed on the floor every time we adopt either a plan or especially the code that implements it. If the code implemented the plan and there's bloodshed on the floor, it must have been a lousy plan, right? Because there's not a shared vision. If there were a shared vision, we wouldn't be having bloodshed on the floor. Neighbors should not be, personal opinion, involved in site plan decisions. It's a technical process of implementing a plan. If we have a good plan and a good code, you don't need to spend your time doing the site planning because the site planning is done by the code and by the technical professionals. Now, admittedly, this isn't where we are today here in Montgomery County. It isn't where we are in most places, so don't feel bad. Policymakers. We have a few policymakers around. Your job is to confirm the planning vision and results. That's really what your job is to say, yep, we've gauged what's going on in the community. This is a good balance, and that's a good plan. And it's also your job to adopt the plan and adopt the code that implements it and stick to it. The technical staff, then, their job is to provide support network throughout the planning process, throughout decision-making processes of adoption, and then to do the technical review after that. Okay, I think those are the ideal roles in the ideal system, and we could spend a long time talking about how to get there from here, but the point is this fits form-based code. Okay, this concept, as you see it, has neighbors involved in planning. It has coded results and plans and codes that are adopted together and that implement one another. And it has technical implementation following code adoption. And you'll hear some more about Columbia Pike and a real-world example a little bit later. So that's probably the time to really talk about that. Some common mistakes in rewriting your regulations. Expecting a miracle. It's a code. My former boss had a T-shirt. You may have seen it at the national conference, those of you who are planners, that said, world peace through better zoning. My new firm's concept is why settle for world peace. The fact of the matter is, you guys started working on mixed use over 20 years ago, and you've been working at it real hard for a long time, and you do a better job at it than most people around the country. But as a package, you don't do the best job of anybody. And so I think that's kind of what the focus of your efforts have to be over the next short while. Planning through zoning. I get hired a lot by people who want to replace their zoning, and they think they know what the plan for stuff is, and therefore they think they know what the code should say, until I take the code out and get creamed in public and discover everybody hated the plan. It was an awful plan. It didn't do this. It didn't do that. It didn't do the other thing. When you do your planning through the zoning process, you're really, really, really too late in the game. Planning needs to happen at the planning stages. The code implements the plan. The final error, in the early days, we got our first zoning codes from standard enabling acts and standard examples. And we've been stealing from each other ever since. And the fact of the matter is, a good code is place specific. There might be a model somewhere that's useful, but don't think that you can simply borrow whole hog, and especially in the form-based code world. We've seen one almost accident with some friends of ours in Ketchum, Idaho, where the planners thought, since they were a small agency, that they would just borrow somebody's form-based code for their downtown. The development community saw the rights that were enabled by the new code and immediately brought two huge hotels for their gateway area that were very, very poorly conceived and overly massive. And they immediately discovered how bad a borrowing job they had done. So this is one of the most important elements in my mind as an outsider, is good code is place-specific. Okay, it is not generic. So, having said that, I think we're allowed to answer a few questions, and I'm going to let Jeff answer some from his show as well.
Yeah, I think if there are questions for either Lee or Jeff, this would be a time where we could take maybe 10 minutes of questions. Then we're going to have a break and get ready for distribution of our lunches and focusing on our afternoon. So, yeah, Lee's coming up here. Folks have questions? Yes.
In the initial suburbanization movement, why was that not followed in France, Germany, and Austria?
I could offer a halfway educated answer to that. I've been over there a little bit. They just didn't have the same opportunity we did. And if you look at the history, my personal take of the development of architecture and planning, it's not so much about American versus European, which is something we got a lot in school, but you know, the Europeans came over here and they had all these great opportunities to do things they'd been thinking about over in Europe. They just didn't have the room to do. In Europe, I saw some of the most insane building forms I've seen in my life. And some of it is they were just a little bit different, so they struck me more than suburban things I grew up with here in the States. But just in terms of the raw land to spread out in, they didn't have that opportunity. They were. It's a much denser population. They still did some very wacky things, and I did an academic project on a city in Switzerland for my thesis, and there was a section of town spreading out in the fields, what used to be more fields, and they had, it was like a museum in miniature of all the, really the same, slightly different flavor, but the same varieties of suburban sprawl that we had here. They were just in sort of 1 acre increments, little boxes, apartment blocks, big towers, etc. The simple answer is, tongue-in-cheek, I would say, crime of opportunity.
I think, too, we have to point to the regulatory system. The view of private property rights in the U.S. is just completely different from the European view of property rights. The public good holds much stronger sway in Europe than it does here in the U.S. We're a little bit more of a gunslinger mentality, even in the Northeast and Eastern portion of the U.S.
I think Rebecca...
Hi. I'm a loud voice. I don't know if I need the microphone, but I'll use it anyway. My question is about one actor that I saw left out of this discussion was the federal government, which we deal with a lot here in the Washington area and here in Montgomery County. And a lot of your discussion is about private developers working with regulators and county councils and others. But, you know, we have, for example, the relocation of Walter Reed to the National Naval Medical Center. And these are decisions that are being made for financial reasons, for security reasons, and those federal requirements kind of destroy this whole idea of bringing things to the streetscape and, you know, closer to the street and other things. So how does this form-based code take into account actors that are large and that you or we as regulatory bodies or agencies cannot control?
I'm personally hoping they grow out of it. We're in the infancy of thinking about those security issues in comparison with places around the world, and we've taken some very infantile measures. I deal with it every day when I go through the airports, and I think many of our urban form measures, and you're describing them in Prince George's County, you know, your neighbor has got equal problems where they cannot attract what they had once thought they would be able to attract, simply because their spaces are not capable of accommodating the forms that they're told they need. I think we definitely need to put more pressure on those entities to be more sophisticated about how they respond to that.
And I think in large part it's a political issue. There are different ways of doing security. There certainly are going to be some things in the federal government that need that James Bond level of security. Other things don't. There are different ways of doing it. But I think it's a political question more than an urbanism question, because they're frankly anti-urban.
I think Matt Nancy has a question there.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone explained Montgomery County to you folks, but our master plans are more or less are supposed to at least have more or less a 20-year lifespan. And everyone holds hands with once a master plan is enacted, and then they start arguing once it's implemented. And I appreciate the objective of nailing down things in advance. But the difficulty is the minute you've all reached consensus, agreement, whatever, enacted codes and whatnot, somebody else comes along with a different idea, which might be okay, which might not. And how do you accommodate changes in economics, in community desire, changes in learning from your mistakes, new ideas that come down the pike the minute you enact the implementing code that implements the plan that once maybe one party was ready to do and then they change their mind or a region wants to do. Say, you know, a couple blocks or half a mile or however this is applied. How do these codes deal with changes in the environment?
I had some nifty slide transitions. It was one of our FAQs, but it was too slow. So I'll have to try and do it verbally. It's a combination of things. First, a well-written code, a form-based code, because it's concerned first and foremost with making things at the community level, urban design. Some of those rules just don't change because someone has a persuasive some architect has a persuasive presentation and accent, speaking as someone who has an unpersuasive accent. Those fundamental things shouldn't change. And a partner with that is that there's a hell of a lot of creativity within that envelope. If you look through the history of architecture, people like Gaudi, Victor Horta, within the envelope of making a building that fronts the street and makes a sidewalk space and a street space and supports community, there is just an incredible room for creativity. To begin with, for the part of the community changing its mind, the community will evolve over time, but if you have a proper process that brings the community together and talks about its vision, I would suggest that the time span for that to change significantly is fairly long, and in any kind of a regulatory or master plan process, and maybe 20 years is pushing it, but there's a need for some kind of institutionalized revisiting. On the other hand, and I don't want to get too much off the mark here, I've been involved with this, what we did in Columbia Pike, what I call a public participation charrette process that involves putting pencils in the citizens' hands and making them plan in a holistic process, making them propose things. It's sort of the opposite of what happens generally now. People come out and oppose projects that get presented to them. But in that process, something very kind of bizarre happens all the time, which is people are surprised at how much they have common, in the big picture, they have common goals, and when they're looking at proposing a future, how much agreement there is among the citizens. I think that underscores there are a lot of fundamentally universal things that human beings want for their human environment.
I think part of the answer to your question, too, is about the constituencies that we listen to. And the beauty of an effectively done planning process with a concurrent code process is that it builds one constituency out of everybody. Theoretically, the development community is agreeing, they can live with it, the property owners, the adjacent neighbors, et cetera. Everybody's agreeing at that point in time, at least, that they can live with this thing. As that thing occurs, it should be occurring on its own. In other words, the best plan is self-implementing. If everybody agreed on the vision, and the vision had been tested financially and in all the ways that it needs to be tested, then it implements itself and it builds itself. And while you may steer the course of it, amend the plan, amend the code from lessons learned, certainly, while you may steer it a little bit, there should not be a fundamental change of mind about whether a place was going to be a place or not. When you do a planning project and you decide that a crossroads is a great place to have some intensity of development, that's a fundamental decision that's associated with lots of infrastructure investment and all kinds of other things. You don't typically then decide you want that to be farmland instead. So you really have to engage the whole planning process to make sure that it isn't sort of revisionary. And I think one of the toughest things, when you were describing your question, what I was hearing is new neighbors move in and start to complain about new site plans for stuff that was planned to come next door to them that their realtor didn't tell them about. You know, I mean, that's the kind of thing that's the reality of what goes on. Nobody ever told me that was going to be a yada, yada, yada. It's amazing how little due diligence we do with our largest investment, buying a house, that we typically would ever make. Do we go talk to the planning department about what's coming? You know, all those kinds of things. No, we don't do any of that. We rely on a realtor whose interest is in selling you the house. So we need to try to change that equation by engaging people. But if, for example, you've had a really effective public participation process, then a person thinking about buying a house who talks to one of the neighbors on the street or on their front porch or whatever else will hear about what's coming, what's thought about, et cetera. And they will either determine that they want to buy into that or not. And so some of those kind of embedding the planning process into the community building process is some of what has to happen. And that cleans out some of the noise in the system. When the system is only working at that final stage of site plan review, you're of course going to get people who differ about what should be next to them. But that site plan review misses out on all of those larger questions of community interest and public good that are decided at that larger planning level. So if we're only fighting the battles at that bottommost level, of course we're kind of in constant frustration and constant course correction.
Let's take a couple more questions. Rose?
In listening to what you've been saying, we in Montgomery County have decided we want to undertake a zoning code rewrite. But it sounds almost like we're doing it in the abstract, that we haven't come up really with a vision to then design the code to. Now, that's the way we do it in our various sector plans. We come up with a vision, and then we come up with code. But the result of that is somewhat this code by accretion. So I'm trying to figure out how we start this process in a way that we truly can get the type of public involvement you're talking about, as opposed to just abstractly writing a code.
You can abstractly clean up the existing code, no doubt about it. You can go through and make it easier to use, put the stuff all in the right order. All kinds of things can be done to make the code more user-friendly than it is today without changing the policy embedded in it. I do agree that that task ought to also be undertaken, but to me, the real code task, the vision and code task, does have to happen at that smaller level. So perhaps the vision of modifying the overall code is one of thinking in smaller pieces as you move forward. But that doesn't mean you cannot tackle the whole code framework, modernizing some things like parking, looking back at the way you treat uses and whether you're consistent in all of your districts. All of those kinds of things can be looked at and make a much stronger, more cohesive, powerful code without even asking those additional questions about, do we want to become mixed use? Do we want to intensify this area? The code is the toolkit, and you can work on the toolkit in the abstract and develop pieces which would be available for implementation in the specific. I don't think you should tackle the countywide zoning map and the amendment of the replacement whole hog of districts around the county without doing that much greater level of detailed thinking about the plan.
And there's a really fundamental point, which is there's been a problem, and it happens nationally. There's a disconnect between people's vision and then the regulatory tools to implement it. If they're apples and oranges isn't far enough apart. You have a community vision, and I imagine in your community processes, the architects come to you, or maybe staff does it. But you have pictures, you have drawings saying this is what we want, and you all have as citizens, you have some idea in your head. And there's a big problem because the rules that regulate what gets built are not directly and even hardly indirectly related to that vision. And we're talking about a set of tools that are more directly related to the physical form of the vision. So it's a way to implement that's more directly related to the vision that you come up with.
We can talk about, here's a question over here.
Thank you. What it seems to me is that there's kind of a disconnect going on, that planners operate at the high level in terms of these overall plans, and then down at the low level of individual projects. And the level that seems to be missed is the systems that operate in between. I think the form-based thing kind of addresses some of that, but I think also the planning profession perhaps needs to learn from police. that they have discovered that they cannot successfully police the community without the cooperation and participation of the community, and that it is not an independent system up here of the gods reaching down and fixing things, but that communities are dynamic systems with many complex parts, and if you sort of just come in and intervene like gods, you very often end up with things with unintended consequences and not exactly what was planned, as you, many of the examples you were showing of these communities that probably look great on paper, but when these things get implemented or end up being sterile and not what was envisioned.
I think that's a great point, and I would bet you that the planners in the room all pretty much agree with you. Something that's really important, and you really, form-based codes as part of the package, unless you're planning for a train wreck, is they're coding community visions that are really agreed upon. Columbia Pike, which is imperfect as it is, worked so much because the community, when it was time to adopt that code, and even a number of the plans that came in for individual buildings, the citizens had been involved in writing and making that master plan, so they felt like it was their master plan. They understood it was holistic, it wasn't a little tiny piece. They understood how the new buildings on the main street of Columbia Pike were supposed to mesh with their neighborhoods right off the pike. They understood it as a complete package that also promoted new development, but also protected their neighborhoods and enhanced them. So we're definitely, in all of this, the foundation for these form-based codes needs to be a really great community plan, a vision plan.
But I think what happens is, unfortunately, you end up with what I characterize as dry-fly implementation, that the plan sits up here and only gets invoked when you have a project proposed, and otherwise the plan and the vision is just basically something there, but it doesn't have any life.
That suggests that the plan is only about the private development, when in fact it needs to include the public investment in the streets, the water, and the sewer, all the other capacities. That systemic approach that you were describing is really what's the most important. And in Jeff's images of what went wrong, we may well have gotten the private property portion right, but then we left some of the rules we left intact in the old way, and therefore we got a half breed that none of us are happy with. So the point would be, if you're going to consider an effort like this, context sensitive streets need to be embedded in the code as well, to be used with what the private sector is doing about zoning. Public investment about, you know, putting these centers and other things in the right places. All of that needs to make sense. Some sensitivity to the marketplace, because we don't want a beautiful plan that simply sits up on the shelf. We want one which has some pressure to be implemented right out of the box. All of those things, you know, sort of the stars need to be aligned to get this stuff to really work. And sometimes it takes a long time to get all of those pieces aligned. So, you know, none of this is sort of magic wand, you know, overnight panacea.
We're going to take a short break now. Speaking of the gap between vision and implementation, we had envisioned being able to pick up lunch at this time. However, there has been an accident on the Beltway, which is delaying the lunch truck. So we're going to take a short break, after which Roger Lewis is going to talk to us, and then we will have lunch. So we get the dessert first. Let's take 10 minutes.
And again, fill out your cards if you didn't have a chance to ask a question, and put them in the box.
We've had a reprieve. The lunch has arrived. Due to good planning, the accident was cleared. The lunch has arrived. So go ahead and pick up your lunch and drink. Take your seat. and we'll get started again in a few minutes.
Just to give folks a 2 or 3 minute warning, we're going to start at about a quarter of our presentation.
Fortunate to have as our midday speaker Roger Lewis. I think everybody in the room is a fan of Roger's, having read his column for years or having been a student of his or having been influenced by his ideas. So it's a great pleasure to welcome him. Roger?
This is an essential tool for me, speaking of tools, because I have a very bad cold. I'm getting over it, I think. But as we speak, I've got a cough drop dissolving in the back of my palate. I'm going to try and get through this excuse me, without too much coughing and hacking. I appreciate your indulgence. Thank you for inviting me to come today and talk on the subject of achieving design excellence in Montgomery County. I'm going to go right into this presentation by making or asking a question. What's the problem? You can see from the text here that that this is a county that has a long history of creating plans whose implementation depends on the zoning ordinance. I think my predecessors up here have explained very well what conventional zoning does, but it's worth repeating this. In fact, much of what I'm going to say excuse me, is going to echo what you've already heard. And you can see, if you read the script, conventional zoning, typically, this is everywhere except in my hometown of Houston, Texas. I was born and raised in Houston. We don't have these things. About which more later. Conventional zoning typically allocates and separates single uses and densities, you heard that, and establishes limits, constraints. The bottom point, I just want to repeat it, it's been made clear earlier, it's not unique to Montgomery County. Over time, as the county has grown, these conditions have changed, the ordinance has grown to what it is today, which is a cumbersome set of regulations. I'd like you to study this image. This again is restating what in graphic visual terms what my colleagues talked about earlier. We, for many decades, the tradition in planning was what you see indicated in this cartoon. These are a lot of the images, by the way, are cartoons from the Washington Post. Fortunately, I retain the copyright. Obviously, sitting around arguing about the colors, Jeffrey, you might want to get a copy of this for your. But I have to do a little mea culpa here, a little confession, because when I first started practicing in 69, 70, 71, some of my first projects were in Montgomery County. For example, it was Roger K. Lewis Associates did the master plan for Churchill in Germantown, which you see here. And this is the kind of, this is what we thought. We thought this was a good idea at the time. This is the kind of planning that we did, which was to throw a bunch of colors onto a map allocating land uses and densities. But, as I've said, over time, this is another cartoon from the Post, things got a little more complicated. So if you read the balloon on the right side, you can see the kind of complexities This was not about Montgomery County, by the way. This was about D.C. You can see the kinds of things that we have to wrestle with and why it's been such a heyday for attorneys. So I've, for years, and this has nothing to do with my coming from Houston, but I long ago came to the realization as a practicing architect that conventional zoning seemed to be